one of the problems that all economists recognize is that there's a labor force problem going on. There's many reasons for it. We're having people spontaneously reassess their life because of an existential crisis where tens of thousands of people they knew died merely from working at the grocery store, driving a truck, or interacting in the world. And so if you wanted to have people encourage them to come back to the workforce, you should make work pay. But what this country has done, and my father, I think, felt this his whole life trying to raise six kids, was that you never got ahead because they taxed work at a higher rate of taxation than idle capital. That is the central mortal sin of this country. And if it's not reversed, it'll never achieve its potential. It will always be about the accumulation of capital to the disadvantage of working families.
And that, Bob Henley, is why you are my favorite reporter and are on this program. Thank you very much, Bob, for your insights, for the reporting you do, and the analysis that you pull out of your reporting. One is as important and valuable as the other. And to my audience, I hope you will agree with me. It's a special time when we hear from Bob, get a depth kind of reporting beyond the norm. Thank you for listening, and I look forward, as always, to speaking with you again next week.
May I use your phone, Mr. Marlowe? Hello? Police headquarters, please. Hello, this is Mrs.
Hello, what do you want, please?
I want to bang.
What?
You me.
I called you. Say, who is this?
Sergeant Riley at headquarters.
Sergeant Riley? Well, there isn't any Sergeant Riley here.
I know that. Now, look, brother.
Wait a minute. You better talk to my mother.
Hey, don't be like Humphrey Bogart. Or Lauren Bacall.
Hello, who's this?
Or Philip Marlowe.
The police.
This is Prairie Miller at Arts Express, urging you to call 212-209-2950 instead. Or visit WBAI.org to help pay for the WBAI radio tower rent and ensuring we continue broadcasting.
Oh, you're the police. Oh, he's the police. Oh, well, that's different. What can I do for you? I can do what? Where? Oh, no, I wouldn't like that. Neither would my daughter. I hope the sergeant never traces that call.
You like to play games, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
And the previous program was Economic Update with Richard Wolff, and that's heard right after the WBAI Evening News on Sundays. Did I just say Sundays? Oh, my goodness. I meant Wednesdays. Wednesdays at 6:30 p.m. here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. And yet, just what Prairie Miller was just saying, one of the most truthful things that has been said about this Tower Fund thing is the importance of the transmitter. The importance of the transmitter existing, and so we can continue to broadcast, and we can only do that with the help of listeners like yourselves. If you take one thing out of this whole campaign that we're doing, please consider showing your support to this radio station and pledge to this radio station so we can continue broadcasting you the distinct and unique programming that is uncomparable throughout the tri-state area and beyond. 212-209-2950 is the number to call or go to give to WBAI New York. It is now 1 minute past 7 p.m. Stay tuned for Off the Hook coming up.
Hello. You're listening to WBAI New York. It's Wednesday, and it's 7 p.m., and that usually means it's time for another edition of Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse. Good. One minute, no!
and a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening, joined tonight by Kyle.
Yes, I'm over here.
Are you over there?
I'm all the way over here.
Okay, we did a lot of testing on these levels, so I think everything is working. We have Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
We have Gila.
Hello.
And we have Alex.
Good evening.
And it's so sophisticated tonight, you can't even tell who's in Skype and who's not in Skype. So we finally arrived after 2 years.
Yes.
Well, this is our last show for 2021. Okay, you know what? I'm getting all the looks and all the pointed fingers and things like that. You want me to explain why I look the way I look? I know it doesn't work on radio. I'm wearing what is known in the medical terminology. It's an ambulatory EEG. And what that is, it's something that measures your brain waves. Now, I'm not doing this for recreation, although I could do it for recreation, I suppose. I'm doing it because I went to a neurologist who suggested I do this based on something I described to my doctor, which I'm pretty sure is nothing at all. It's just occasional light flashing, like every 8 months or so, and a little bit of confusion. It's called a painless migraine, I believe, is the official word for it. But they said, just to be safe, why don't you do a couple of tests? And I figure, you know, it's the end of the year. My deductible is at its, I met my deductible this year. So why not have a whole bunch of tests? And one of them involves walking around for 3 days with this electronic device. Your head is basically wrapped up in this, how would you describe it, Kyle?
Bandage?
Yeah, I look like a mummy. So I've got that on my head, all right? And I have this electronic device.
What else can it do?
Well, I don't know. I haven't really hacked it yet. Well, actually, this is my last day, so I'm not going to really try and mess around with it.
Yeah, you seem fairly comfortable.
No, I'm not comfortable. Believe me, this is not comfortable because I'm walking around with this, you know, first of all, I've got this bandage on my head. I look crazy as it is walking around with a bandage on my head. And I have this device strapped to me, and it's got a button too. It's got a red button on it, which I'm supposed to press if I have an episode. I'm not having any episodes, so there's nothing I have to really worry about as far as that goes. But, you know, it's not the kind of thing you walk around in public with. So I've been kind of keeping to myself. And there's a tablet that records information. There's a camera that's supposed to be on me at all times, which, you know, it's not. I'm not filming myself 24 hours. But that's why I look the way I look. Does that answer everybody's questions?
Well, it does, because I wasn't going to say anything. Okay, I was totally going to say something. But, I just happen to have something that might be useful here. It's a deck of cards. You can see this one is a circle and a star.
Wait, you're trying to confuse me?
Lines and so forth. And if you'd like to do some tests with me later involving this deck of Zener cards, we'll talk after the show.
Wow, but, you were right there with that. But no, it's not something that I'm concerned about, because this is something that I've been experiencing since 2005. Occasionally, I just would, maybe after straining my eyes, I'd find it difficult to read, and I'd have trouble remembering things for about maybe 15 minutes. If I close my eyes and sit in a dark room, it goes away. I, you know, basically just described that this year when I got a checkup. I've described it every year, and my doctor said, you know what, just to be safe, why don't you have, you know, a neurologist give you some tests. So that's what I'm doing. It's the end of the year of trying to, you know, get as much advantage as possible from the fact that I met my deductible. So next year, though, it's going to go right back down to zero. So I'll have to be extra careful. So,
surely you're not the only one. I bet others are getting as many things taken care of at the end of the year. So that seems practical.
Well, some of the staff in the neurologist office, in fact, they're getting things done, because when I went in earlier this week, basically 80% of the office wasn't there because they all got COVID over the holidays. So, yeah, very quickly from their relatives, apparently. So there's a lot going on, and we're all experiencing it in one way or another. So, yeah, that's where I stand right now. Anyone else have any interesting stories?
Nothing that I can follow that with.
Okay, well then let's continue. This is the last show of the year. And as is sometimes our tradition, we like to reminisce about the year that has just passed and think about things for the year that is to come. So I'll start. Basically, it's going to be pretty simple for me. I think the thing that in the world of technology or hacking, the thing that stood out the most to me over this past year was the concept of NFTs. You know, it's these ridiculous images or anything really, just images of art that people buy, and yet they somehow don't actually own the art. And they're paying huge amounts of money for this. If anyone can explain it to me, people have tried to explain this to me, and it never works. Non-fungible token, I believe, is what it stands for. Yeah, and the concept has you know, people have tried. And I get what they're saying, but I just don't understand how anybody can spend a penny on something like this. So that, I think, is what was the most... I guess, interesting development in the technology world over the last year. I know they've been around probably a little bit longer than that. My prediction for the future is that it's all going to come crashing down, all right? And people are going to realize that this is nonsense, and they're going to stop, or they're basically just going to not do it as much. You know, I saw something online a few days ago that basically was someone talking about how back when he was a kid, somebody named a star after him. And somewhere up there in the sky is a star with his name. Now, the company that keeps the records for that star that bears his name, it's not around, hasn't been around for a long time. Those records are nowhere to be found. It's a whole damn star, and they can't find it. They can't find any records. Somebody paid money for that. It's all gone. So good luck with your NFTs, because I guarantee you the same thing is going to happen. Okay, anyone else have a... Kyle, go ahead.
Well, I think mine was maybe a little less interesting, but the concept of supply chains and logistics, specifically with software, I know there were a lot of like breakdowns, the solar winds, and other basically software maintenance programs. And the dependency on a lot of really important systems, on things that are contracted out and you know, not always paid attention to with the same sort of vigilance. So I think that theme, people learned a lot about that. And then it ended up being something that was topical in relation to the health crisis and overall economic woes. We had a canal get blocked, and everyone was freaking out about, you know, getting their goods and stuff on.
You know,
time.
That boat went back into the canal a couple of weeks ago.
It did.
It was the second time, actually. It went once before, but yeah, it's always fun to see that boat come back.
So yeah, I think we learned so much about what globalization means on a day-to-day level, like the really boring stuff. And maybe we, I'm thinking our, paying more attention to it and having an appreciation for what it takes to live and operate in the world as we thought we knew. For the coming year, I think that it's mostly this concept of 1 foot, this paradox of being both in the future but also being in like the deep I want to say prehistoric past, like this idea of analog and digital. There's a lot of talk in like moving from different energy sources, moving from different levels of reality, like depth in media, having different types of trusts, networks, and I think that has made both the virtual and real life sort of blend back and forth. So I think this joining of stuff that is very old school, but also the combination of that with sort of the newer themes, I think we'll enter into all kinds of things. But I also think that new and shiny, great virtual things like is being discussed, like people like escapism, mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. Where it's gonna, there's gonna be fits and starts to that. People trying it out. And I think mayhem will ensue. You know, we'll realize that virtual places can be just as ugly and nasty as we've come to see the Web 2.0 and any further.
I think we've realized
we'll have
that.
The same moderation issues. We'll continue to face questions until we actually face them collectively. Uh-huh. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah, totally. And so, I like the idea of bringing in the old as well.
Well, we're constantly talking about how there's older and newer, and we do live in that society. America is very future forward. There's a lot of innovation and very extreme high tech, but there's so much that is like 2-3 centuries ago and even further that we still rely on, and attitudes, even sensibilities, I think, in the cultural realm, but also in people's day-to-day lives, like where people actually live in this country. They're not at the extreme edge of technology, but I think there are growing exceptions where people might be in far-flung places, but they're bringing in elements of the future and tools and sensors, all the kinds of things we know and think of as a growing futurism. I think those are going to be in the most lo-fi places first. If that makes sense.
Yes.
The frontier, the digital frontier, I think is going to become further out in the frontier.
Interesting. Well, I look forward to that world. I think that's quite realistic. Who wants to go next? Hans? Rob, go ahead.
Well, I'll go next. The big thing that strikes me, and this is kind of a continuation from 2020, but something that really struck me in 2021 is how after lockdown, of course, and this was back in 2020, we all had to, like so many people had to learn to work from home, to go to school from home, to telecommute rather than physically commute. And I think what we found this past year is that so many people have accepted that as more of a normal thing. It's no longer weird. In job ads now, it's a normal thing to see, you know, remote okay, you know, you can apply for jobs in states all over the country or even outside the country. And I think that is really striking, how it's become something that the average person has access to, can use, understands now through being forced to use it for this long. And I think as we go forward, I have to say, if there is ever an end to this pandemic situation, I still think this will become a new normal for a lot of people who prefer it or work better from home or, you know, learn better going to school from home. And it will become sort of a fact of day-to-day life rather than something unusual or strange. I think the whole paradigm has sort of shifted. You have entire businesses now that don't have a physical office. You have bands that collaborate from all different places and put out albums now where they're never in the same place, but they can get it all done. And just this is a fascinating new dimension to how things used to be done, and has also led people to, I think, reconsider that traditional go to the office for, you know, 40 hours a week model that everyone had just been doing for generations. And so I find that really interesting.
Wow. Well, Rob, before you get into your future, a question about that new world that now exists of remote working. Has this happened yet where somebody is working for a company completely remotely, but they're also working for another company completely remotely, maybe even in the same field, maybe even a competitor? I mean, somebody has had to have come up with that scam by now.
Well, in the sort of gig economy, that sort of thing has existed with freelancers, like kind of having multiple clients for the same kind of work, and sometimes, yeah, working on them at the same time, which, you know, check the terms of your contracts to make sure that's cool before you go start doing that sort of thing. But I think my prediction for the future is just that this will continue to be more and more of a normal thing, more and more of an acceptable thing. And you know, for people who work better this way, I think it opens up new dimensions for them.
You got to predict something new, though, because you're predicting more of the same, and that's not new. You know, do you think something crazy might happen with, I mean, what I just came up with, where people are working for their competitors at the same time, that's a prediction for something different that this gig economy or remote working might bring forth. If you need a few minutes to think about something, possibly, do you have something off the top of your head?
Yeah, off the top of my head, there is, right now there are fields of work in which you can easily work from home. You can sign into your computer remotely and go from there. I think something that will be added to all this is maybe the ability to do more kinds of work remotely through things like robotic telepresence. I think for a while I was working in manufacturing where I had to physically be there to operate machinery and work with components and things. And something like that could conceivably be done from home if you build the right equipment and set it loose in a factory floor. And that opens up all kinds of further interesting questions about what it means to have a job.
Okay. I'm disappointed no one's come up with anything involving drones yet or robots, but I'm sure. Alex, it looks like you have something on your mind. Go ahead.
Oh, I've always got a lot on my mind these days, Emmanuel, as you know. In terms of milestones, though, for 2021, I'm going to build on something that we talked about over the last couple of weeks. I think Log4j is really, really significant. I think this Log4j Java library vulnerability has really been a revelation about the weakness and the fragility of the systems on which we rely on a daily basis, and how they too, like us humans, are connected in ways that are deeper and more fundamental than our outward appearances would have you believe. Separately, I think a big milestone this year too, I think, has been advances in VR technology, virtual reality. It's really been amazing. The immersive qualities of this technology are, in my mind, really, really astounding. The games are, they have an intensity and about them that I've never felt or seen before. You can watch Netflix these days in a virtual theater right now, which is pretty cool. And I'd venture to bet that you could probably even attend an Enya concert in the near future.
Wait. What do you mean you can watch Netflix in a theater? How does that work?
Yeah, on this new Oculus Quest thing, which I hate to say, is developed by Facebook, not our favorite company, or Meta now, whatever the name of the day is. But sure, you can install this Netflix application on your headset and log into your Netflix account, and then all of a sudden it feels like you're in this virtual theater watching a movie, fully immersed.
Wait, are there other people in this theater?
No, there's nobody else.
Well, good. I don't want other people in this theater. I don't want people making noise or getting in the way.
Yeah, well, I absolutely. I mean, you can do whatever you want in this virtual world. It's really, it's incredible. And I think it really dovetails with what you were talking about as well, Emmanuel, and your confusion about the NFTs, which you are by far not alone in having this type of confusion.
I don't think it's confusion. I think it's common sense. But go ahead, if you believe otherwise.
Well, I think that the whole concept of NFTs dovetails really well with the concept of this virtual world or the metaverse in which we're going to be living in, where there may be one digitally signed copy of something that belongs to you. And I believe that NFTs are essentially a proof of concept for how we're going to own real estate in the quote-unquote metaverse in the future, that all of this is going to come around full circle. And what really terrifies me about that is if we are going to buy things and they're going to be akin to NFTs in this virtual world, then the rules and the space and everything about that particular universe is going to be created by another company, a company perhaps like Meta / Facebook. And their ability to set those rules and create value out of essentially nothing, which is really what an NFT is.
We agree on that. We definitely agree on that. And, the fact that you're referring to it as real estate. Don't forget, real estate is called real estate because it's real.
Because it's real.
It's real. Right, I don't have no idea if that's what has anything to do with it. But the fact is, NFTs, they really aren't real. And Farmville is not real. But people think it is, and they throw real money at various things. And I don't know. I seeing more of that is just scary, because it's like a drug addiction. Money goes down the drain.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead, Kyle.
No, it's amazing that we're talking about the same company that we were just talking about having failed a lot of people in the realms of social media and and been brought to task, taken to task over how they've handled it and addressed people's concerns and moderated, et cetera, et cetera. We're still having those conversations. There hasn't been a resolution to it yet. They're the types of entities that are going to be building a world that people will escape to from their lives. That is a way of coping with reality, which I don't know. I mean, that's probably been an argument made in video gaming for a long time, but this is a different level.
Yeah, I think, though, this whole concept of NFTs and akin to real estate will become more accessible and real if that NFT represents something that is more akin to a physical space in a digital realm. If you can look to that NFT as essentially a property deed of a certain space in the quote-unquote metaverse, then I think things will fall into place more quickly. But it's terrifying to me to think that all of this property, real, digital, or otherwise, virtual, whatever you want to call it, can be created essentially out of nothing.
Right. I mean, imagine food as an example. You know, an NFT of food. You're still going to starve to death, no matter how much of it you own.
Yeah.
You know, work that out. Get back to me, and then maybe I'll believe in the concept. But until then, it's just, a rich man's game. Now, was that your future prediction?
No, in the future, I want to, I think more Log4j vulnerabilities are my prediction for 2021.
More of the same, though. You can't do more of the same.
Well, as a result of those variant vulnerabilities that are going to be identified, I believe, in this Log4j library, I'm predicting more and more ransomware events that are going to be affected as a result of that vulnerability. But separately, in going back to the issue of social media platforms and things, I think there's going to be more accountability for the foreseeable consequences of algorithms, especially with regard to the psychological harm and the amplification of misinformation. I think this is going to be a direct result of the whistleblower, Frances Huygens, I think was her name, from Facebook, as well as pressure from lawmakers, academics, independent researchers, and everybody who's been clamoring for more of this data in the wake of what happened almost a year ago on January 6th. But separately, my prediction, I think there's going to be some developments with respect to the world at large here, too. And I'm going to crib a little bit from the last article that I wrote for 2600, the last column. And I think
as long as the author doesn't mind.
Yeah, well, that's fine. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no copyright violation here. But with respect to the world at large, I think because of the coronavirus and its lethality, we're going to have no choice but to acknowledge the interconnectedness of human beings. And this will bring to the forefront the duty of care that we owe to each other and the need for empathy to triumph right now over apathy. Because if we turn a blind eye to each other, we will be perpetually disrupted by these various variants, one after another, as we are right now.
And you can see words like that in every issue of 2600 Magazine, penned by Alex himself in his artificial interruption column. And
that's right, which has been a lot of fun. I can't believe it's been over a year that I've been doing that.
Yeah, it's
amazing. During the pandemic, and it's almost a serialized column in the sense that it builds off each one.
Well, it started with a problem you were having activating a phone or something, right?
That's true. During the Hope conference, when my iPhone broke and I had to go replace the iPhone in the middle of the worst bit of the pandemic at that point. So that was fun.
Wow. Yeah,
definitely an article. Definitely the first article was definitely worth reading for sure. You know, the others are okay too.
Okay, Gila, all comes down to you now.
Ooh, very exciting. So before I get into either my most significant moment of the year or my prediction, I just want to talk about NFTs for a quick second, because something that's been percolating in my mind as we've talked about it and we've learned more about it is that the hacker mindset, as we understand it, as we have explained it on this program, especially to our young caller on Overtime a couple of weeks ago, which was one of the greatest moments of the year as far as I'm concerned, the hacker mindset is, I understand this, I'm going to share it. We want to make things clearer to people, better for people. And the NFT mindset is, I own this and you can't have it. And the worst thing an NFT believer can call you is a right clicker, or so you have a right clicker mindset.
Yeah, what is that? I've been seeing that insult thrown around lately. What does
right.
that mean?
So what it means is that this is the picture that I paid for. I own it. And you miserable peon, you're going to right-click on this image and save it to your computer for free. You are stealing from me, you right-clicker.
It sounds to me like they're realizing just how easy it is to bypass what they have done, all the money
exactly,
they've spent on something that's worthless.
Exactly, and how stupid this whole venture is. Because if you spend however much real money, and it's a lot of money in some cases, mm-hmm. on a picture of, I don't know, a monkey in a hat, and I can right click on the picture of that monkey in the hat and I can have it for free.
Uh-huh.
It kind of shows that you did something real stupid. But well, they get up, yeah.
I could take a picture of that
slur in the NFT world.
I could take a picture of the image that you save and then sell it to somebody else too. What does that make me?
I think it makes you clever. But
wow.
I am not an NFT head. So speaking, Alex, what you were saying about the interconnectedness of human beings kind of brings me to my moment of the year, which is a couple of moments. And I'm thinking about the day that the Meta servers went down and took like half the internet with them. And there have been a couple of times when Amazon Web Services went down and took like half the internet with them. And I think the fact that we are consolidating so much of what the internet is, what the world is, in the hands of a very small group of organizations is problematic at best. And I think when we're saying, okay, everybody can have all of this stuff and everybody's going to use it, but then if it's not there anymore, you know, I know that there were hotlines, there were ambulance services that rely on WhatsApp for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. And when all the Meta servers went down, there were people who couldn't get medical help because Meta went down. So I don't know what the solution is. I don't know how we solve it. I don't know if there's a possibility of like a rebalkanization of all of these services. I'd like to see that happen. That is not my prediction for the year, though, because, well, when you hear my prediction, you're not going to think I'm that much of a realist either. But thinking about how we can spread things out a little bit more, because AWS keeps dropping and so many things go with it. Mm-hmm. That, I think, that was my technology issue of the year.
Uh-huh. Well, just to address that for a moment, I think if you look at almost any industry, we see the same problem of consolidation. You know, it's communications, for networks, television. Everything is being bought by a relatively few amount of corporations, organizations. What is the solution? And I think the solution is always, you know, diversify as much as possible, have independent people come and start become their own media. But then, you know, you kind of have the side effect of, oh, everyone's the media now. And that includes every crackpot under the earth. And then all of a sudden, there's no legitimacy. And you don't know who to believe. And everyone just believes the people that they follow and nobody else.
It's like the extreme consolidation versus extreme democratization.
Yeah.
Which a lot of the newer technologies have allowed for that democratization. But there should still be a consolidated effort, especially in things like news. We've talked a lot about radio, too. Talk radio is incredibly consolidated with owners. Newspapers have suffered from this as well.
Absolutely.
All aspects mm-hmm. of media. And so that is an incredible observation.
Yeah.
My prediction for the year is not a prediction. I don't think it's going to happen, but it's my hope. Can we go with that?
Sure.
What I would like to see is a valorization of rest. Because one of the things that we have seen, as Rob said, that more people can work from home and more people are realizing that working remotely and working from home is more of a possibility, is that more people are working more hours than ever. I would like to see us as a country and as a culture stop valorizing the grind quite as much.
Uh-huh.
that, you know, people are saying, oh, what did you do during the pandemic? And if you didn't learn a language, monetize your hobbies and lose 50 pounds, you were wasting your time during the pandemic. And like, we stayed alive, a lot of us. We learned things, and just because we didn't earn money for them doesn't mean that it wasn't worth it. I think that to valorize rest, relaxation, recharge, a minute to breathe, and that the idea that if you can't monetize it, it's not worth it, I'd like to see us step away from that in 2022. Again, it's not a real prediction, but it's a deeply felt hope.
That is excellent. That says so much, because throughout the world, people work themselves to death, literally sometimes. And I remember back when we did the first Hope Conference, we were making fun of those AT&T commercials. Remember those? Where basically they just made up some technology didn't exist. And you know, basically, did you ever send a fax from the beach? You will. And the company that will bring it to you is AT&T. I think I have that right. And first of all, they're claiming credit for things that didn't exist at the time. But why would you want to send a fax from the beach? You're on the damn beach. Enjoy it. And that world has come to be where people don't know how to enjoy themselves. They have to work all the time. My idea for this, which I just came up with, by the way, you know how in China everyone is freaking out because kids are being limited in how much they can play video games. And I think you get 2 hours a week or something crazy like that. And then I don't know how it turns off, but it does. What if we did the same thing for work? Okay, where you basically, you know, you're on your work connection, or you're doing work related things on your computer. And then all of a sudden, a message comes across saying, you've worked enough. Now go relax. And it's enforced. I don't know. That's probably not the answer, but I think something, that's the mentality we need to get into. You know, if you haven't relaxed enough, if you haven't done something for yourself today, it's time to do that.
Well, there's that AT&T ad campaign you were talking about still lives, and there's a current ad campaign for Google that does the same thing, and I saw it on the subway, unfortunately, when I was on the way to work, and it was a list of places you can work from with your Google connection. Work from the beach. Work from your bed. Work from their bed. Work from the train. Whatever it is. And it's like, no! Just take a breath. Draw a line. And, you know, if we get back to that ideal of 8, 8, and 8, for what it's worth, the VPN my company has me using when I'm working remotely does disconnect after 8 hours of connection.
Oh, really?
You can sign right back in, but yeah, it boots you after 8 hours.
Interesting. It's kind of like my idea.
Yeah.
I really like that too, because it's also a real reevaluation of, how to spend your energy, and that the reward for things that you work on isn't necessarily compensation all the time. And we have a really hard time getting people inspired if it isn't something monetary, where there's some financial benefit. Other than that, our society largely looks at everything else as free time, if people even get to that. So I just think there's a lot in what you're saying on even deeper levels. There's many layers to that, and I think there's so many worthwhile things people can invest in as far as working on.
Yeah, I saw this thing today on Twitter that's being passed around. Have you seen this? It's basically geared towards musicians, and it's a calculation of the number of streams that musicians have to achieve in order to make $1. From their music, $1. I'm going to read off a list of what they have to accomplish. And just try to remember how it used to work, you know, where musicians would sell records and get a cut from that, and have recording contracts and things. From Amazon Music, they need 249 streams, 249 people listening to their songs in order to make $1. Apple Music, 128. Tidal Music, whatever that is, 78. Napster, 53. Actually, Napster is the best deal. Interesting, isn't it? I mean, think about when Napster came out back in, what was it, 2000, where that was seen as somehow ripping off artists. And in fact, they're giving them the best deal in the digital world. Deezer, 156 streams to make $1. Pandora, 752. Spotify, 315. But you know what the worst offender is? You guessed it, Google. YouTube Music. You need 1,250 streams to make one lousy dollar if you're a musician. Now, I can't speak to the accuracy of these numbers. That's being passed all over the place on Twitter, so it must be true. if it is true, if this is anywhere based in reality, this right here illustrates one of the major problems that we have, where the people, the artists, the people who are creating things, they're the ones in last place. And you better believe these companies are making a killing from those people. And that's a huge issue.
And at least then they could go in, there was like a recording label they could go in and confront. I mean, these are basically just web pages they're visiting to see how their distribution and audience is growing. They're not actually able to advocate in a large way, especially if you're a new artist.
Mm-hmm. Gila.
A quick research check-in is that Napster, and talking about consolidation, Napster is now what used to be Rhapsody. The Rhapsody service became Napster in 2016.
Was that Real? Made by Real?
Possibly.
Real Networks, the Rhapsody?
It's very, very possible. Because things just keep getting eaten by other things. And I will be interested to see if this sort of chart will exist in another year and how many platforms will be on it.
See, I keep going back to not to fixate on the way things used to be, but the value of owning a record or a CD and showing your support in that way, knowing that when you buy something, that a good percentage of what you are paying is going towards that artist, at least in theory. I know record companies do all kinds of shenanigans, have done that in the past, but at least, you know, you felt like you were voting in some way. With either your concert ticket or you know, your record purchase. And, you know, we can say that digitizing everything has made it a lot more palatable for some people, but I don't think the artists are the ones benefiting from this. It doesn't seem that way. Alex? Alex, I think you're muted.
Yeah. No, sorry. I'm having a little technical issues here today. It's a bit of lag. But you know, this whole notion of music and streaming and services and profit, it really only works out for the artists when they can stream at a much larger scale.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, if you have hypothetically 40 million streams on a song per month, that would equate to about $160,000 at $1 per every 250 streams. That's a lot of money per song per month, but you can only ever get to that rate if you have some kind of boost from popular culture, and usually that means some kind of massive marketing campaign by way of a music label or some kind of corporation behind you or some kind of corporate promotion of your music throughout the airwaves, throughout streaming, and through all the streaming services, rather. And so for independent artists, it becomes very, very difficult for them to break through and make a meaningful wage from this, and it almost forces them out of the market itself, which I think is very, very unfortunate. And the scale of this has to change in one way or another, or we're just going to be stuck with this homogenized view of popular music, which is what we had on the radio 20 years ago, and it annoyed the hell out of me then.
I like where you're going with that, Alex, too, because I think it wraps people up. It's really management, too. It wraps the artist up in this sort of branding machine, and they become something they didn't really intend to be as a recording artist. They're out doing, like, endorsements and things that getting really far afield from, like, having their music be performed or sold widely. Like, they're sort of forced to say, like, okay, well, this is success, and that means you have to be in all of these different ads and all these different platforms and modes, and you have to do a collaboration or some kind of crossover appeal on this program or series, and that keeps you relevant and therefore gives you more endorsements. And before you know it, you're just basically, like, in this ad cycle, and you only got exposed to through your wish or desire to perform music, which is crazy to think about, that like we laud the success of an artist on things that really are all externalities to the craft itself, which is music.
Absolutely. Rob?
The thing is, the traditional entrenched big label music industry has always been very, very good at underpaying their talent and at taking things that challenge their sort of rule of the entire system and market and everything, and just absorbing them or taking them down. I have right here on my desk, I have a CD that I bought. I got it a few weeks ago.
Oh, good for you.
It's from one of my favorite bands, and it's a hard piece of media. And, the first thing I did when I received it is I ripped it to digital files that I put on my devices and stuff. And the CD will go up on a shelf whenever I get around to cleaning my desk. But if I spend, $15 on this independently produced CD, they probably saw the vast majority of that money because they're the ones getting the things printed up and putting them out and doing it as an independent act without the help of the major labels who are very good at just making numbers like these Amazon Music, 249 plays to make a dollar sort of things look good. So I want to say if you have music that you enjoy, track down the band's official sites, official stores, buy things from them, get a T-shirt, get an album. I know a lot of people like vinyl records again. Get some of those because that is how you're going to keep your favorite artists, your favorite creative people able to do their work. The big music industry is still not the way to go. It's still screwing people, and we can see that clearly on this.
If you're one of those artists or bands, I think the best thing for you to do is to have your own website where you have an account on an online store that doesn't take the majority of your profits, and you sell this thing and you send it out yourself. You send out the CDs, you send out the shirts, and you don't farm it out to Amazon or anybody like that, because they will take a huge cut and you won't make anything. And this way, people who are fans of your music will say, I want to support them, I want to buy a CD. And like what you did, Rob, you'll have the CD on your shelf, and you'll digitize it for your various devices. And then when Log4j comes calling one day and you lose everything, you have that CD to go back to so you can encode it again and start over. See, that's an optimistic view of the future, Kyle.
I like that too, because the people landing on your site, if you're hosting it, they won't be as susceptible as they would to having their demographics and so on fed into advertising, which would take away their disposable income that they would otherwise maybe spend buying your merchandise and your CDs. So if like they're being just to get to your site, they have to go through all these storms of ads, the risk of them buying with money they would otherwise spend at your web store is a lot higher.
Right. And the thing is, if and when you become major successful superstars, that's the time you put it all on Amazon and let them deal with it, because you can't be bothered. If somebody needs to get your music delivered to them by drone in the same day, that's a better solution than you running it yourself and going crazy trying to deliver merchandise. But when you're beginning, when you're small, when you're not making a whole lot of money at this, doing this yourself, basically having a website, having an online presence of one sort or another, that is by far the better way to, and it goes for writers as well, people who publish books, artists of all sorts. I think we would see so much more in the way of new artists prospering and having a path to becoming more successful. Because I guarantee you see small artists on Amazon, half the time it's counterfeit work that is basically using their name. I know at least one musician, when I mentioned, hey, your CD's on Amazon, they never put it on Amazon. Somebody else put it on Amazon. Amazon doesn't do anything to prevent that. And they're not making a penny off of those sales. Amazon is. Amazon's making money from that. And, of course, the counterfeiters are making money. So that is what happens. That can happen if you're running your own site. And if you see it show up on Amazon when you didn't put it there, you can draw attention to that and hopefully take some kind of action.
Yeah, it's not your own doing.
Yeah, exactly. Alex.
Yeah, and speaking of which, I just took a quick look at the monthly listeners that Enya has on Spotify, since I know that's one of your favorites. Emmanuel, and 3.6 million monthly listeners. So at scale, this is going to is really going to work out for Enya. However, I know one of your other favorite bands, the Scottalites, right? How many would you venture to guess that they would have?
Well, you know, if you asked me this question 20 years ago, I would ask you what you're talking about because Amazon didn't exist. But I would basically guess now today a mere fraction of what Anya gets. I'll say maybe 250,000.
That's a pretty good guess. They actually have about 489,000
okay.
monthly listeners, which is not bad.
Uh-huh, but there's a lot of them. There's a lot of them, though, Alex. There's more than one in the Scottalites.
Oh, well, that's true. Yeah, absolutely. In fact, it's quite a large band.
Like 50 people in that band.
The horn section.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but let's say that equates to 1 million streams per month.
Okay.
That would be $4,000.
That's not enough for the horn section even. No.
Feed that family. You know, and if you multiply that times 10, it's still arguably not enough to feed the Scottalites, given the size of that band. So, you know, these economics just don't really seem to work out at scale.
No, but the convenience does. It's way convenient to be able to click a button and hear the music you want to hear and think that you're contributing. And you're really not. You're contributing to Amazon and to the large companies that are doing these streams. But that's it. That's really it.
Yeah, you keep them in center spotlight as far as the dominant player.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we had a lot more to cover as far as 2021, but we're going to have to continue that over on Overtime. And the way you get to Overtime, and by the way, we are not on next week. We're preempted, and we'll be on again in 2 weeks. But the way to get to our Overtime show is go to youtube.com/channel2600. You should see it there. It goes live at 8 o'clock. Or you can go to www.2600.com. And click on the link at the top of the page that goes to Overtime. And you can make phone calls then. You can ask us questions, share experiences, various things like that. Also want to remind people to support WBAI in these closing days of 2021. We are basically trying to pay our transmitter bill for the whole of 2022, something we've never done before. Pay in advance. Imagine that. We can do that with your support. If you call 212-209-2950 or go to the website give2wbai.org, give the number 2wbai.org, pledge whatever you can afford to the transmitter project, I guess is what it's called, right?
Yeah. I think fund or project.
Fund.
It's hard to say quickly, but
it
is. Transmitter but, fund.
Yeah, but you know, you can pledge one amount. You can pledge something every month. It all goes to the same place for the same purpose. And it's amazing when you think 2 years ago we were out on the street, or actually a little bit more than 2 years ago, we were out on the street because of a coup attempt from various factions. And the history of the station was very much in doubt and very glum. And now, not only are we back on the air, we've moved to a new transmitter site, we've cut expenses, we're in the black instead of deep in the red, and we are basically ready to take the next step, and you can help us do that. 212-209-2950, give2wbai.org. 2021 has been an interesting year, and better than 2020, I'll say that, but you know, I'm hoping 2022 will be much better than 2021. And my fingers are crossed. I'm looking forward to it. Is anybody else? Am I the only one?
Yes. We are very much looking forward to it. And, you know, I have hopes. I have hopes, and let's see how they do. I have hopes about my hopes.
I also have hopes about my hopes. One hope that is going to get us to hope is that if you have plans for Friday night, please stay home. Just stay home.
Yeah. Why not?
Stay home.
Makes sense to me. There'll be crowds of people everywhere. We don't need that.
Yeah.
All right. Join us over on YouTube. We'll see you in 2 weeks here on WBAI. Stay tuned to 99.5 FM because we have all kinds of great programming throughout the week. Write to us, oth@2600.com. For Alex, Rob, Gila, and Kyle, this is Emmanuel. Happy New Year. We'll be right back.
building bridges. I'm Mimi Rosenberg, saying WBAI needs you to step up to keep our press free, to allow its message to radiate out over our signal, and to keep that signal keeping on. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. Donate to the Tower Fund at $17,000 per month. We're on a campaign to raise next year's tower rent in full to pay the basics so we can prepare to build for the future. Pay those essential bills now so we can plan to create additional platforms to broadcast our truth-telling, our content, our messaging, by podcasting, video, digital forms of delivery. So let's pay that $17,000 a month tower rent, $250,000 for the next year, now, to give us a solid foundation, a free press to arm ourselves to beat back the fascist attack, to prepare for empowering ourselves with the knowledge we need to build a democratic society. So whether it's $5,000, $1,000, $500, $100, dig, give us those dead prez. $5,000, $1,000, $500, $100, or 100 of you right now stepping up to the plate. 100 of you pledging $25 right now. Step up for a free press. Step up and donate to our signal, our Tower Fund. Donate by calling 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. I'm Mimi Rosenberg. I'm Mimi Rosenberg for Building Bridges. Saying, stay strong, stay well, and do the same for our station. Keep it strong, keep it well.
Whether you get up early on Saturday morning or stay up late on Friday night, we have good news for you.
Back of the Book, the only radio program that has endorsed hell, will be there for you every Saturday morning at 5 a.m.
Regular listeners will no longer have to figure out which Saturday morning is the alternate one. Back of the Book, every Saturday morning at 5, only here on WBAI New York.
This is WBAI, and this is Fred Eagle Smith for WBAI in New York. Stick it in your ear.
And all right. Thanks a lot.
Just about 8 p.m. WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. Time now for What's Happening with Ralph Pointer.
Say all the things that I should say them.
WBAI 99.5 FM. And this is the last Wednesday in December, Wednesday, December 29th, 2021. And the co-host this evening is, of course, Ralph Pointer and yourself, Betty Davis. And without further ado, I want to turn the mic over to our co-host, Ralph Pointer, who will tell you about the exciting program we have for you this evening. But I want to remind you that nothing that involves liberation comes without a cost. And WBAI is on the front line of every struggle that matters in the issue of human rights since its inception. And we need you more than ever tonight. We need you to call in your donation at 212-209-2950. Brother Ralph, your mic is open.
Well, thank you, Sister Betty, and good evening, my brothers and sisters. And tonight, what we are doing is getting a jump start on one of the issues, one of the programs, one of the situations that we have promised over the years, and that is to get youth more involved in radio. And our program this evening does that very well. It's a discussion and an analysis of a model convention which will actually take place in April 2022, developed and organized by Dr. Kelly Harris. Now, who is Dr. Kelly Harris? Dr. Kelly Harris is a professor that the students at Seton Hall demonstrated to bring him from Chicago to improve the situation of black representation at Seton Hall University. He was the chair of the Chicago Council on Black Studies. Kelly Harris is an assistant professor and coordinator of African American Studies at Seton Hall University and director of the Talented 10th Leadership Program. He also was the director of international studies at Johnson C. Smith University, and his areas of concentration included African American studies, African politics, black political thought, and the history of social science. His most recent publication is Manning Marrowbow, Humanizing Malcolm or Denigrating Legacies. Only those who keep up with their reading will make sense of that. Which appears in By Any Means Necessary, Malcolm X Real. Not Reinvented by Herb Boyd, Ron Daniels, Malana Karenga, and Hakai Maduhubi. Excuse that manipulation of that word, Madhubuli. Dr. Harris is a graduate at Temple University, BA at Ohio State University, master's at Clark Atlanta University, where he got his PhD. He was born in Philly, PA, and has a wife and three children, but I won't give the program away. Dr. Kelly Harris, take it away from there.
Before you do that, can I throw in just one more thing that
yes,
we love about this particular young person that's coming up to replace us in the next generation? He is an advocate for political prisoners who are responsible for all the human rights that we uphold today.
Thank you for that, Sister Betty. Dr. Harris, the microphone is yours.
Thank you so much, Sister Betty and Brother Ralph, for having me this evening.
I hear nothing.
And, can you hear me? Hello? Hello?
Yes, we hear you. Please go.
Okay. So thank you so much, Sister Betty and Brother Ralph, for having me this evening. And I want to give a special thanks to Russell Maroon Schultz for his life and work, and condolences to his family as we move forward. So I want to talk to you tonight about the Model Gary Convention, but I would be remiss if I didn't talk about the Gary Convention. And for your listeners out there who want to read more about it, a professor right there in New York at Sarah Lawrence College, Brother Kamosi Woodard, who was there at the Gary Convention in 72, who was a part of the Congress of African People. He wrote a book, It's Nation Time, which is about Amiri Baraka and his life and work. And he gives a great analysis of the Gary Convention. Also, Robert Smith, who just retired recently at San Francisco State College. For a long time, he was in the African American Studies and Political Science departments there. He wrote a book called We Have No Leaders, and that gives a great analysis of it. And there's a more recent book by Leonard Moore on the Black Power, on the Gary politics and Black Power. But with that said, with that caveat, so the Gary Convention, most of your listeners may remember this. It was 1972, so we're coming in the 50th year anniversary of it. The mayor of Newark, New Jersey, Raz Baraka, and the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, Chokwe Lumumba Jr., will be co-hosting the 50th anniversary of the Gary Convention at the end of April and beginning of May of next year. And it makes sense to host it in Newark. Mayor Baraka's father, Amamu Amiri Baraka, was one of the lead organizers and a motive force for the Gary Convention in 1972. So it makes sense that it should be held in Newark. But with that said, the Gary Convention in 72 really was an extension of the work that was happening across the country in the 1960s. As you well know and your listeners well know, rebellions started in 1964, 1965, 1966 yearly. In this country, you had rebellions in Harlem, in Rochester, New York, in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in Watts, in Detroit in 1967, and, of course, in Newark, New Jersey in 1967. During that same time, you had people trying to figure out how to grapple with it. You had conservatives, radicals, revolutionaries, all trying to figure out how to grapple with what's going on in the urban areas. Black activists and leaders came together and started a series of national Black Power conferences. And the major one was right in Newark in 1967, which brought together H.Rap Brown, Maulana Karenga, who is the founder of the US organization, also one of the founders of Kwanzaa, and who else was there? Dick Gregory and some other folk came together at that. And out of that conference in 1967, one of the ideas that came out was to boycott the 1968 Olympics. But other than that, and more importantly, they were going to have a series of discussions of national Black conferences. And these political conferences really was hearkening back to what Black folk did prior to the Civil War. From 1830, you had the first Black political convention, in what they called it at the time, called Negro Convention movement in 1830, and they would have them annually, almost annually, every year, all the way up until the Civil War. And they would have them by states. Newark would have a Black Power Convention, Negro Conventions, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, and so forth. So really what they were doing in the 1960s was hearkening back to what happened in the 19th century. So it was a part of our tradition when we want to grapple with problems to convene, to discuss, to debate, to try to find the best solutions. So from those Black Power conferences in the 1960s, the Congress of African People held a major conference in 1970, and out of that came the National Black Political Convention in Gary, Indiana. Coretta Scott King was a part of the committee. Mayor Richard Hatcher from Gary, Indiana. That's why they hosted in Gary, Indiana. Amiri Baraka, Jesse Jackson, Congressman Charles Diggs, all were a part of the committee that helped form and create the first National Black Political Convention in Gary, Indiana. Over 10,000 people attended. Almost 2,000 elected officials were involved. Betty Shabazz and Coretta Scott King were involved. The Nation of Islam, League of Revolutionary Black Workers, Congress of African People, the Black Panther Party, and so on and so forth. So you had activists from all stripes that were there. One of the goals was to create an independent Black political party. But the other, and more importantly, was to just deal with the issues that were pressing to us, some contemporary, some historic, prison industrial complex, living wage, health care, how to deal with U.S. foreign policy towards Africa and people of African descent throughout the world, primarily in the Caribbean. What is our policy? What should our policy as black folk be toward Israel-Palestine issue? So all these issues were part of the dialogue and discussion. The goal was to come up with to create a black agenda that was separate from the two major political parties, whether the Republican and Democratic Party. And of course, it had its challenges. We didn't come out with a independent black political party, and we can talk about that and why that didn't happen and the failure of Gary. But overall, it was a success in terms of energizing people, putting things on the table, and creating really a model for us for what should be done. Now, what we're attempting to do, so, you know, for years, there's in colleges and high school, there's something called a model UN that students participate in. And it's a good